Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with writers in the studios of North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wiegman.
My guest today has always been an adventurer. Kurt Koontz learned to love the outdoors growing up in Boise, Idaho. After a successful career in sales, he retired early to seek new meaning in life. In 2012, he walked the Camino de Santiago de Compostela across Spain. This long, transformative journey on foot inspired Kurt Koontz to write his first book, A Million Steps, a memoir that forged friends and connections around the world. One of those friends led Kurt to Rishikesh, India, where he began to study yoga as a physical and spiritual practice. Kurt Koontz has now written a book about his adventures in India entitled Practice. Kurt Koontz, welcome.
Nancy, thank you for having me on your show.
Well, people might wonder, if you have had all these adventures, you're probably asked to give speeches. What do people ask you to give talks to their groups?
Yeah, they do. I give quite a few talks, and I really enjoy it. That one-on-one connection with people, you can feel the energy and passion in the room. And yeah, I really enjoy doing that.
What kind of things do they want to hear from you? What about your adventures or your expertise do they want to know about?
What I really try to encourage people to do is to break their routines and to understand that nothing happens inside of a comfort zone as far as personal growth is concerned. So I try to use some examples that I've had in life and then try to really encourage people to, you know, possibly wake up today and think about doing something different than they did yesterday, which is the only way you'll really find some growth and hopefully a little more happiness.
Well, now, you're a successful businessman, and then you decide to walk a pilgrimage across Spain. What made you decide to do that?
Well, I actually checked out of business quite a number of years before that. I graduated college in 1986, and then I went to work for a company called Micron Technology, which is in my hometown of Boise, Idaho, and I was in sales there. And in the year 2000, I just kind of had an epiphany and said, there has to be more to life than kind of working for the proverbial man. And I decided that I would step back. And I thought, I'm just going to see if I can't work for a little while and see how that goes. And I never went back. And it's not a story of, you know, checking out with millions of dollars and I hit, you know, Google at the right time or something like that. I've always lived, you know, within my means, and I've just found that adventures in life are much more important. And so I started that really in the year 2000, and I started to take more and more journeys. And I would say really the most significant journey of my life was the 2012 walk in Santiago, just Santiago on the Camino, which both you and I have done. And it was, I mean, every adventure has kind of sculpted my life. That was a life-bending trip. And that resulted in my first book. And oh my gosh, I'm so thankful for that that walk.
My guest is pilgrim Kurt Koontz. His first book was about his walking the pilgrimage. It was called A Million Steps. And Kurt, you mentioned that I walked this pilgrimage too. And so the paragraph in your book just rang so true to me. It reflected my experience as a pilgrim. And I know people who haven't done this think, oh my goodness, that can't be true. But here's what you wrote. While walking along the Camino de Santiago, every day was filled with the unknown. I had no idea of the upcoming terrain, no reservations for sleeping, no walking partner. I did have a walking partner myself, but, and absolutely no control over the weather. As I let go of my need to control, synchronicity seeped into my life. I began to develop a faith that things would work out. I saw that if someone twisted an ankle on this path, the next pilgrim could easily be an orthopedic surgeon from the Mayo Clinic. As I tried new things, I also gave up my attachment to the outcome. And this sounds just like, oh, that can't be true. You're walking along, you sprain your ankle, and here's an orthopedic surgeon from the Mayo Clinic coming up behind you. But that happened so many times. this young pilgrim was walking so that his feet hurt. And my partner and I asked him, you know, what's your problem? And he said, well, I've been camping outdoors where I've got a lot of rain, and my shoes, he had on leather shoes, he said, just didn't dry out, and my feet just are soaking wet. So when he took off his shoes, his feet were in really bad shape. But guess what? The person looking at his feet was a nurse. And so other pilgrims said, well, I've got some gauze, and I've got some tape, and I've got some antiseptic. And all these pilgrims gathered around to support this young man. And I thought, so many pilgrims, so many other people have helped me along the way, that here's maybe a chance for me to help a fellow pilgrim. And all I did was hold his foot while other people wrapped it and took care of it. And then he said, and I was so touched. And he said, you know, I prayed about this last night. So we other pilgrims were the answer to his prayer. And often it's not even thought about. You just, when you need something, somebody is there to supply that need. I know it sounds crazy, but that was my experience too.
It's an amazing place to be, Nancy, and we're both very lucky to have experienced that walk. I don't think it was, for me, a really good training ground to attach myself to the moment. And I believe that when you do get involved in the moment, that the synchronicities that are around everybody all the time, you're not aware of them, because you're in the past, you're in the future, and you're not, it's kind of like your receptiveness to these synchronicities are not there. So when I walked the Camino, I just had synchronicity after synchronicity. It just was like raindrops falling out of the sky. There were so many of them. And where I've taken that into my life 8 years later, I find now that I take synchronicities for granted, and they happen all the time. And when I find they're not happening, that's when I stop and I go, what am I doing wrong? Because they're always around me and they've gone away right now. And I figure it's something I do. So I shift my energy, my attitude, or whatever it may be. And if those synchronicities are not coming down in my life constantly, I'm doing something wrong. And I believe they're out there for everybody all the time.
You know, one time I thought, we never had to sleep outdoors, but we were prepared because you don't know, you don't have reservations. And the one time I thought, well, I guess this is the time, because the hostel was full and there was nobody in this little town. But this lady showed up and came to our rescue. Oh my gosh, who would have never dreamed that that's how we would be rescued. Well, now you make this trip on the Camino, but what made you decide to go to India?
Well, I think every decision you make in life ultimately comes out and there's a new manifestation that happens based on a previous decision. So I decided to walk the Camino in 2012. I then wrote a book about it, and I ended up doing a number of speeches. And during one of those speeches, there was a guy just in an audience who was sitting close to me, and I started talking to him and talked about the Camino. And he said, hey, there's a lady I know who's very much into the Camino. And it turned out it was a mutual friend of ours just through Facebook. I didn't really know this woman very well, but we had at least, you know, we're Facebook friends. And she was in India, and she was in an ashram in a city called Rishikesh. And I didn't know what an ashram is. I didn't know what Rishikesh was. And India was never on my radar. And I just reached out to her and said, hey, our mutual friend Brian is a great guy. And she said, yeah, I've read your book and I walked the Camino and blah, blah, blah. And about a week later, out of the blue, she sent me a note and said, Kurt, I know you travel a lot. I really feel that you need to come to India and come to Rishikesh. And it was kind of like a lock going or a key going into the lock. I just immediately felt yes. And I pulled up on Rishikesh because I knew nothing about it. And it said the city was about 100,000 people. And I thought, well, that sounds better than, you know, one of these Indian cities with 20 gazillion people. And so I like the size. It's right on the Ganges River and about 30 miles from the headwaters. It's at the base of the Himalayan mountains. And so I'm going, that sounds good. And then the city is referred to as the yoga capital of the world. And I had just a few years prior to that started to get very novice yoga practice, but something I was doing with some regularity. And then my favorite part was, I don't know if you remember, but the Beatles took an iconic trip to India a long, long time
ago. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's where they went. They went to Rishikesh. And I just said, my gosh, if it's good enough for, you know, all these stars lined up, I'm going. And so I took my first trip. And the first time I went for 6 weeks and lived in an ashram, did yoga, did everything you would do in India. And it was an exceptional experience. But had I not walked the Camino and not written the Camino book and not done the Camino speeches, there's no way it would have ever happened. So it's just a continuation of the journey that unfolds.
My guest is Kurt Kuntz. He is a pilgrim, a yogi, and an author. Now, he, you mentioned the Beatles going to India, and in your book, you reproduce some artwork, and on one page, you have Beatles Ashram Art, and it's under the section, some of your sections are more like essays. It's not like chronologically, I did this, and the next day I did that, and this little chapter, this essay, explains a question people may have come up in their mind saying, well, Kurt, how do you just pick up and go? What about your spouse? What about your children? You just leave and go wherever you want to go? And you kind of explain that. You start by talking about when you were in your early teens, you expected to have, you know, get married, have children. And did that turn out?
Well, I think it turned out I didn't take the traditional route. as you just mentioned there, I really thought when I was younger that, you know, working for a big corporation, and I thought, like a lot of, you know, people in my family, that I would just ultimately get married and it just naturally would have children and all these things would happen. And it really didn't. And there's another side to that that I talk about in these books. I had some alcohol trouble. And I think that when you have alcohol issues, I think you're not really as open to relationships as you should be at all. And so I don't think I was really a great candidate for it at that time in my 20s and early 30s. And then I quit all that. But I've ended up, I'm not married and I don't have any children. I've had some incredible women in my life for long periods of time, but I've just never ended up being married. And I like the free spirit of being able to move around and kind of, you know, like the India trip. I mean, I get a Facebook message that says, you need to come to India. And I just said yes and went. And there's a tremendous freedom that comes without having the normal traditional attachments that people have, being with family and you know, wife, children, etc. And so it's a different lifestyle. But some of my friends go, gosh, I mean, you must be so unhappy because he just doesn't have these things. And, you know, there's pros and cons to everything in life. To be able to, you know, to hop on a plane and go somewhere and do what you want to do is pretty liberating. And ironically, my mother is, she's recently become a widow from my stepfather, and she's terrified of being alone. And I think I've been alone for such a long time that I may have crossed that watermark where I may just, you know, end this way. But I'm open to everything. And it's just, I think that's the answer to everything. Say yes to every experience, and just go with the flow, man.
Well, you also remark in your book, and I bet people wonder, well, Kurt, maybe you're using travel as an excuse to avoid intimate relationships.
Well, maybe I am. I really don't know the answer. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry, Nancy.
Well, you just say in your book, I'm a single guy who has no plans beyond 6 months and who usually spends 6 months of the year traveling. And you say, maybe I'm hiding behind borders, but you say, you know, you're looking ahead 6 months, but it doesn't sound like you're ruling out some kind of intimate relationship that would be close to somebody. It's just that you're saying at this moment, right now, you're content with your life as it is.
I am very content. And it really began, the first journey I did was a bike trip through Europe, and it was in 2006. And I literally landed at the Amsterdam airport with a bicycle and two panniers and, you know, a couple of pairs of socks and stuff. And I had no map or anything. And I ended up, I rode 2,000 miles. I took the trains 2,000 miles. And I didn't have a map. I'd wake up and say, I'm going to go to this city. And then I think I can make this one. And I rode through 9 countries. And I've been, I think it was 40 plus cities. And it was just an incredible trip. And then, you know, at the trip, I met friends from the world. And then I started to go to Costa Rica. And I have friends in Costa Rica. And then I started to go to India. And the first India trip didn't end in one trip. It ended up 5 trips. So in the past 5 years, I've spent 6 months of my life in India. And now I have a bunch of friends in India. And the city I'm in now is only 150 miles away from my home in Boise, but I'm in a city that's called Sun Valley, Idaho, and I have plenty of friends up here. And I just find these pockets of communities of really good, interesting, and they're very diverse people. One of my best Indian friends, a 26-year-old woman. Another one of my favorite Indian friends is, I think he's 70 years old, and he's just a great human being. Up here in the community I'm in now, the other night I had also with some fellow pilgrims, we had a barbecue, 4 generations, 96-year-old matriarch of the family, and the great-great-grandchildren were, great-grandchildren, 5 years old and 7 years old. Now, I mean, I couldn't have scripted a better day than that. And to watch one of the boys made a hedgehog out of a pine cone. The little girl was very, you know, inquisitive, a number of questions. Those are just great experiences to have. And just again, say yes to everything.
After a break, I'll be back with my guest, adventurer and yogi, Kurt Kuntz. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, Kurt Kuntz, author of 2 memoirs, his latest about his trips to Rishikesh, India. I mentioned this, if you want to call it a chapter, Kurt, that you entitled Love, and what you say when you conclude that, and some of it is not original to you, other people say this, but I really like the way you concluded this chapter. You said, love is wanting the best for everyone, and having no attachment to the outcome. Just like success, me winning does not mean you have to lose. Love is not a zero-sum game. Life offers an infinite and eternal supply of love that is meant to be shared in each interaction. I used to think that a partner could make me happy, but maturity has taught me that happiness comes from within. Happiness is something to be shared, and not something to be gained from another person. And a lot of people say that, you know, that your happiness comes from within, don't rely on somebody else to make you happy. So that last part is not necessarily original to you, but your life is examples of this, that love is wanting the best for everyone and having no attachment to the outcome. Those are words to live by, I think, Kurt.
Well, thank you. And I think that, you know, the attachment to the outcome, what that really means is you're trying to control. And the minute you take control into relationship or or you know, I did this for this person, therefore they owe me that, yeah. Or I was, you know, I mowed the yard, this person needs to do that. Just then you're in a game. If you just give freely and try to be kind and put your best foot forward, and you know, we all have some darkness inside, and the yoga to me, which I know we'll get to in a bit, the yoga has really taught me to turn the internal light on. And once your internal light is on, holy Toledo, you can share with everybody so freely. And if you have the light, I believe it's your duty to share. And you can share everywhere. You can share to a stranger you meet. You can share with the person in line at a coffee shop. Just, you know, especially with all the problems in the world today, which, you know, we could spend 3 months talking about them. I believe if you can just be nice to the people close to you, your friends, your family, the stranger you meet in the line or whatever, but most importantly, be kind to yourself. Because if you're not kind to yourself, you're going to be unhappy. And if you're unhappy, you have no light. And if you have no light, you can only share darkness, and darkness spreads. Just be nice to people. Do you?
Well, I think one advantage of staying in the present moment is you get a sense of, in your book, you refer to spiritual and health vibe. And you mentioned, it comes up when you go back to Costa Rica and you go to this, you call it a sleepy surfer community that had the spiritual and health vibe that was missing from my previous trip. And I know he was a businessman, so he's a no-nonsense kind of guy, but he was looking to buy a boat. And in fact, he ended up buying one in Amsterdam. But when he'd stepped on a boat that he didn't get, he said, "Nope, I don't like the energy on this boat." And so he got off. And I think sometimes we don't realize that we can pick up energy of a place. And you just mentioned it right there when you went back to Costa Rica and you found a place that had a spiritual and health vibe that was appealing to you. Well, now that we've talked about that, that you traveled to India, you traveled to Costa Rica, you went to India more than once. And I was curious when you started talking about yoga and surrender yoga. I mean, there's so many kinds of yoga. And so I'm reading along and you say people recommended, "Oh, Kurt, you should go to surrender yoga." And we as a reader are surprised when we found out what that was. What was surrender yoga?
You know, it was just a beautiful thing. There's a little place in Rishikesh called the Juice House, and everybody goes there and they make this incredible juice, and there's a bunch of yogis there, and they're all typically all foreigners. And I would just go in there and ask, "Where do you go for yoga around here?" And they kept saying, "Surrender, surrender." And I thought, gosh, surrender yoga, what a cool name for a place. And I finally found it. Someone told me, they go, "You can never find it. You have to have somebody take you there." So this one woman, in the middle of the day when there were no classes there, she showed me this secret path on how to get to this mysterious building with no signs. And I got there and I kind of looked at the building and go, "This is it. This is the famous surrender yoga." And so it was it. So I came back for a class, and it's a 4-story building, and the yoga studio is on the top floor. So you have to sit in the stairwell and waiting. And I was just making sure. I asked her, I go, "Is this surrender yoga?" And she just started laughing at me. And I was like, "What have I done wrong? I mean, did I offend you, or what's wrong?" She went, "It's not surrender. His name is Surrender, Surrender Singh. And he's the legend."
And it's spelled not like the word, our English word, surrender.
No, it's S-U-R-I-N-D-E-R. And moments after that, all of a sudden, I hear this om, the sound of om, and it's vibrating around the room. I go, "What are they doing?" And they go, "There's a teacher training up there, so they're training people to be future yoga teachers or whatever." And I thought, wow, that's really cool. And, you know, then I went up and took his class. And the class was transformative, life-changing. It was incredible. And so for the rest of that trip, I ended up taking a lot of classes from him. The next year, I ended up taking a lot of classes. And then I went back and ultimately enrolled in one of those teacher trainings myself. And I spent a full month with him and 16 other human around the world. And Surinder Singh is probably, he's just an amazing yogi. Super talented, no ego whatsoever, and just pure compassion. One of the greatest souls I've ever met in my life.
My guest is adventurer and author Kurt Kuntz. His first book was A Million Steps, about his walking the Camino in Santiago de Compostela in Spain. His newest book is Practice, and he is just telling us how he came to take yoga classes when he was in Rishikesh, India. And you mentioned this guy. He seemed a role model for how we would all want to live our life. Surinder Singh.
This guy is incredible. Here's what he told me. He told our whole class. He said, I have been doing yoga my entire life. And 17 years ago, I was in a class just like you guys are, but not a teacher training, but a regular class. And my teacher looked at me and said, I think you need to teach the class. And he said he was so afraid because he didn't want to let his teacher down, but he didn't really want to teach. But he thought, I know enough about this that I could maybe get up there and, you know, fake it till you make it or something. So he took over the class, and he said that he did about 5 minutes of traditional asanas, and then he put everyone into Shavasana, which is the final corpse pose, and you close your eyes and you relax. And he said, then I grabbed all my clothes and I ran out of the room and I ran home. And he goes, I was afraid to go back for a week. And ultimately, I came back and I began to teach. And then he said, so I started teaching around here. And pretty soon, I had more rupees than I had ever had before. And I kind of patted myself on the back and he said, oh, Surinder, you're so good. And he says, then I would walk around town and people would point at me and they would say, there's that teacher, there's that man. And he said, again, I would pat myself on the back and say, oh, you're so good. And he said, one day I woke up and I realized I didn't invent yoga. I did not invent one pose. I didn't invent one breathing technique. And I believe that my gift and my purpose in life has been to share yoga. And his belief is no one can teach yoga. All you can do is share it. And he said, when I took my ego out of it and stopped patting myself on the back, realized this was my gift, and I now feel it is my duty. Therefore, for the past 17 years, I effortlessly share it with everyone that comes to my classes and comes to my training. And that's some powerful stuff. And you can take that same story into any part of your life. Remove the ego and you remove so much resistance to what you're supposed to be doing. So it was really, that's just one of a million stories I could tell about this great human.
Well, you know, my first yoga teacher, I hadn't been taking long, and she said, you should be a yoga teacher. Alva, oh my gosh, I'm not at all flexible in any room. I'm the least flexible person. And so that was my view of yoga, a flexible person. And so when she told me I should be a yoga teacher, I thought, nope, I don't qualify to be a yoga teacher. And I was reading your book, and your first reasons for going to a yoga class were not so spiritual, Kurt. Why did you originally seek out a yoga class?
Well, I very easily say in the book, I've always been a big exercise person. I like gyms. I like hiking. I like biking. I'm just an active person. And I was actually talking to an ex-girlfriend, and she said, have you ever tried yoga? And I go, no, not really. And she goes, well, you should. The odds are in your favor. And I go, that's a pretty good point. It's a room of, you know, typically very fit women, and you know, exercise. So heck, you know, why not, you know, up my chances here. And so I started to do yoga, and I started out in hot yoga. And
where you barely wear any clothes because it's so hot.
Yes, it's a real advantage. And I just thought, you know, it's another form of exercise. And, you know, yeah, maybe I guess you get limber and you stretch and all these things. And I did that for a couple of years. It wasn't until I got to India where I really began. My yoga journey obviously started at my first class. But when I got to India, it was the first time I heard things like this. Everyone talks about a flexible body. How about transferring that flexible body into a flexible mind? and then think about all the things that you can do with that. In the Shavasana pose, it's called the corpse pose, which you obviously know, but some of the listeners may not. You literally lie on your back, and they say it's the most difficult pose because you're motionless and you're trying to relax. This is what Surinder would tell us. He goes, relax into your body, breathe deeply, and wherever you find tension, breathe into that space and let the tension go and relax. He said, now take that into your life. When you're into an uncomfortable situation in life, just take a deep breath, breathe into it, relax, and accept it. And the problem melts away. But instead, it's so easy to get into that situation, and it's confrontation time, and it's time to punch back or whatever it may be. And then your life is just turmoil. And learning to, you know, to relax into your body can help you relax into a lot of other situations in life. And that's the idea of taking yoga off the mat. And ironically, I've said this to a lot of people, and I do a lot of yoga still 4 or 5 times a week. And you know, I used to look at some of the pretty girls in class, and now I keep my eyes closed almost entirely. And the entire journey is internal and within. And the exercise benefit is a nice trinket that you pick up along the path, but the path is stillness of the soul, focus on the internal, realizing everything you need is within inside you, and transferring that stillness to your head. And it's just a beautiful practice, and I really enjoy it.
We're going to take a short break, and then I'll be back with author Kurt Kuntz. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is adventurer, author, and yogi, Kurt Kuntz. And he spent his training time in Rishikesh, India. And the Ganges is just iconic. And one of the things that a lot of us who don't know much about India do know, that the Ganges is where cremations take place. And you describe going to one and witnessing a cremation. And describe that experience for us, Kurt.
Well, it's kind of a bigger story, Nancy. And where it started, the first night I got to India, I'm at this ashram. And every night, 365 days of the year, they have a ceremony called Aarti, A-A-R-T-I. And they refer to it as Indian Happy Hour. And the sun is setting, and because of there's pollution in India, the sun is always red. And so you're sitting right at the banks of the Ganges River, and this sun is going down, and Aarti is a celebration of light. And the Indians, the Hindu belief is that fire purifies everything. So it's really a purification ceremony. So there's mantra, there's chanting, and then at the end of it, there's all this, these candle looking things are passed around. They're actually, it's ghee burning, but there's probably 40 or 50 of these lamps with flame on them that are passed throughout the crowd. And it's really an amazing ceremony. Well, my hostess pointed across the river, and the river is like 200 yards across. So it's not a small river. It's an enormous river, 200 yards across. Think about that. 2 football fields. and there's two fires over there. And she goes, you know what that is? And I go, I don't. She goes, that's cremation. And I just sat there and I go, oh my God, here I am with 500 people. And we're kind of celebrating the sunset. And there's all this joy and happiness. And right across the river is the end of the line for another human. And it just moved me. Well, I was afraid to get close to that area. And 3 years later, when I was in the teacher training with Surrender, I was walking by the area and there was a cremation taking place. And I ended up kind of getting closer to it. And originally, my experience with death, my first experience was my grandmother, and I was in the third grade and she died. And I didn't understand death at all. I mean, still hard to deal with today, but then I was really mystified. And I remember my brother told me grandma died, and I'm like, that means she's not coming back. And I mean, like, she's really gone. And so that was hard to grasp. And then when it was time for the funeral, there was an open casket. And I look at this waxy figure, motionless, and it just scarred me. And it was not good. And, you know, then I've had some friends that have passed. And then in 2001, my father died. And, you know, that was a horrific experience. And my stepfather died a few years ago, and that was a little more accepting. I was just more able to kind of talk. But over there in India, it's so out in the open. And what happens is you're sitting by the river, and all of a sudden, a bunch of men come down, and they're all carrying kind of literally logs, pieces of wood on their shoulders. So five guys come by, and they got these big logs, and then some more people come, and they have some smaller sticks. And right on the edge of the river, they actually build a little, it's called a pyre, P-Y-R-E. And I believe it's almost 1,000 pounds of wood. And they build a platform, and it's just amazing how it comes to, it looks like carpenters have sculpted this platform, if you will. But it's just, you know, raw materials from Earth that end up being carried down there. And then they do a ritual of the body in the river, and they put the body onto this platform, and then they put more wood on top. And then the eldest son takes a flame from a smaller fire, and it's typically the one that ignites the flame. And then it's quite a fire. And the people just sit around, and it's so out in the open. It's so natural. You're in, you know, the body's carried down by four friends and on their shoulders, looks like a gurney type deal. And their body's great. It's wrapped up in white cloth, and marigolds are dangling from it. And it's just, you're on the banks of this river, and there's a whole bunch of friends around, and they all talk. And I don't know, it was just like, wow, man, this is maybe more than it's supposed to be. And in our lives in the West, it's also sterile and hidden behind things and, you know, body bags and people, you don't see anything, and you die in a hospital alone or something. And it's just so weird to have it be so open, and, the ashes return to the river. And it was remarkable to see. And then I became more comfortable with that, and I've been back to India. I've witnessed it many, many more times. And I think it's just helped me with my own acceptance of our ultimate fate for all humanity.
My guest is Kurt Kuntz, and he's describing a cremation he witnessed on the banks of the Ganges in Rishikesh, India. And you also notice that, and if listeners heard you say, men brought these things down. And you notice that there were no women allowed at the cremation site.
Yeah, it was really it was a moment for me. I was sitting down there, and I'm watching this whole thing, and all of a sudden I go, wait a minute, everyone down is a man. I don't understand this. And so I went back to my yoga shala, and I sat down with Surrender, and I said, you need to explain this to me. This seems like a very prejudice type deal, and, you know, excluding women again, and on and on. And he goes, I'm just going to tell you a story, and you may not like it, and it may not go within your beliefs, but this is the belief structure that we have. We believe that men are born without any form of love whatsoever. And without having love, there's more of a tendency for some more kind of logic to potentially be involved. Not saying women are not logical, but that men have drifted too far in that direction. And so they realize that the only way that the spirit can be released is through cremation. And it's just part of the process. If you do not burn the body, the soul can never be released. And not releasing the soul would be an ultimate sin of life. And so I made the comment about how casual everybody seemed to be. And they're kind of like talking, about what you do last weekend, why this fire is going on. And he said, that's just, part of the structure. It's what happens. And he said, women are the pure source of love. And when someone dies in the family, the women are very involved and they help. If a woman dies, the women prepare the body. If a man dies, the men prepare. But they're very involved and they walk all the way from the neighborhood down to the river. But roughly, right at, say, a quarter mile away from the river, they turn around and they do go home. And the way that Surrender tried to explain it to me, and again, I'm not advocating this, I'm just repeating the story that he had. He felt that if women are too exposed to watching a loved one burn, that they would have to suppress their love. And because women are the pure source of divine, unconditional love, if they push that love down too far, that there would be a potential that they may stop reproduction. Because the art of having a baby is the ultimate act of unconditional love. And again, part of travel and the beauty of it is just to get a different perspective and to hear somebody's reason for something. And so that was his explanation. And something I thought initially was very discriminating and rotten from his viewpoint, he made it sound like a pretty gosh darn beautiful story about how women are the source of all love. And I was blown away by his explanation.
Well, I'd like to contrast that, Kurt, with what you experienced here in the United States when your stepfather died. Now, he was elderly. He was 87 years old. And you say your mother called and said, I think he's dead. You need to come over now. And he said, when you got there, there was no question. He had passed in his sleep. He appeared to be at peace. And you say, like my previous experiences with death, this one seemed appropriate. You say you spent 10 minutes at his bedside. And anyway, you end up, somebody says, did you call 911? And he's talking on the phone now. He says, no, we've not called 911. Yes, we are sure. You're sure he's dead because his lungs are not moving and his body is cooling. Okay, I'll call them. He called 911, explained the situation. I heard him say again. Now, this, by the way, this is somebody named Mike who was the son of the deceased. And so he's on the phone. He called 911 and I heard him say, no, there's no need for EMS. He's deceased. Okay, thank you for not sending them. Moments later, I heard sirens blazing and saw a bulky red fire truck trying to maneuver down my mother's lengthy driveway. A white ambulance followed. Soon there were four strangers in the house to confirm Stan was truly dead in his bed. They were all polite, but this procedure seemed a bit much. The ambulance team left, but the fireman stayed behind. And I said, what's the process? When do you leave? And the fireman said, when the police get here. Soon, two squad cars were in the driveway and three policemen were on the doorstep. The blue team relieved the red team. They were kind and thoughtful and asked some basic questions. I had one of my own. As a taxpayer, this seems a bit insane. Why are there three of you? I found a morsel of comfort when one of the policemen said they always send two, but the third man is in training. As kind as they were, their welcome was beginning to wear thin. Again, I asked, what is the process? When do you leave? The same policeman said, there's no foul play, but we need the city inspector to come before we can leave. About 30 minutes later, a brand new white truck with flashing orange lights joined the caravan of vehicles in the driveway. A serious lady stepped out of the car, put on some surgical gloves, and approached the door. Without offering a word of condolence, she said, "Please move to the side. I need room for a clear photo of the entryway and the steps leading to the bedroom. Do not disturb me. I will also need all of his prescription pills." With that breath of fresh air, she snapped her way into the bedroom. The city inspector was followed by the coroner, who confirmed the death and asked, "Would you like me to call the funeral home?" By this time, all three of us burst into laughter. My stepbrother said, "Yes, that's what we tried to do 4 hours ago." The inspector called but frowned as he hung up the phone. "They're very busy and will try to be here in about 90 minutes," he explained. Two professional death salesmen later showed up at the door in their finest suits. They had brochures in hand and a gurney. Moments later, Stan was wheeled out of his house in a red velvet body bag. The fancy salesman left mud stains on the carpet. That red velvet bag was, for me, the visual symbol of how Americans hide from the death that is exposed in full view on the banks of Mother Ganga. In India, old people are cared for and honored. Death is a natural part of existence. In the West, we see death as unnatural or surreal. We fear, repel, and reject it. In Rishikesh, my accumulated fear of death began to dissolve. I'm reading the words of Kurt Kuntz from his latest book called Practice. And Kurt, I could see how that just, it got to be ridiculous.
Oh my, I mean, such a dramatic point in life. And to sit there and just go through all these people coming into your house and nobody offering any kind of, you know, condolence or, you know, all these city employees, it was like, wow. I mean, it's an 87-year-old man who's, you know, passed away naturally, you know, fortunate for him. To be over there in India, I asked some of my friends, I go, "Well, how long before you die, before you get cremated?" He goes, "Typically the same day." So it's just, it's so quick. And there was another moment when I was, I'm going to kind of back up a little bit back to that cremation. All through my yoga training practice, my teacher would tell me, we are all made up of the five elements, and those elements being earth, water, fire, air, and space. And if you really get down to it, the earth would be your bones. And when you think of, water would be blood, urine, semen, whatever, any liquid that's inside of your body. And then as you go on to onto the fire, you can think of things like your digestive system. You have an actual furnace type thing in there. And then air, just think of the air inside of your lungs. And then space would be the hollow portion of your ear, your nostrils, and some other things like that. And I'm looking at this solid ground and I go, oh my gosh, I'm on a rocky shore, so there's sand and rocks. And I'm looking and I go, wow, that's earth. And then right behind that, I see the water. And this river, you have to see this river in your lifetime. I mean, it's just so enormous and it's so beautiful. It's a piece of art. But I go, earth, water. And then I see this fire. A human being is being cremated in there. And it's a huge fire, a big flame. And I go, wow, there's the fire. And then I kind of see those fumes on top of the fire. And I go, well, I guess that's the air. And then I'm looking up at the top and I go, wow, I'm in this river looking up at the Himalayas into infinity. And that's space. And, you know, for a lot of yogis believe earth, water, fire, air, space. And sitting on the banks watching that cremation, it all just came together. And I thought, again, that another synchronous event. How we began the conversation, what an amazing observation to see. And so it was really a moving situation. But and then also, while that's happening, life goes on. I mean, there are other tourists just walking by. They don't even know what's going on down there. And there's birds flying around, and there's women just barely upstream that are in the river washing their clothes. There's people downstream that are taking a bath in the river, which is a very common thing to do. And the tuk-tuks are full of tourists and people are taking yoga and people are selling food. And it's just like, it's just part of the process. Very open, very open.
Well, and it's heartwarming to hear your stories about the friends you make, both from other countries all over the world and from the native people who live there in Rishikesh and who take to you and have show you such warmth and friendship that it's really heartwarming to hear that. And we see why you would stay there when you have currency problems that come up that can be so frustrating to deal with the bureaucracy there in India. But but you do deal with it, and because you don't have a choice. That's what you do. And whatever comes up, you deal with it. And you make that point of staying in the present moment and how important that is.
Very important.
Well, Kurt, you must be thinking about another book, or do you have another book in the pipeline?
I don't know. I probably do, and I guess that, you know, when I went to Spain and walked the Camino, I never thought about writing a book. And halfway through the trip, I thought, my gosh, this has been such a mind blowing experience that I think I need to try to share this. So I wrote A Million Steps. And then I did all the speeches. The speeches took me to India. And after my first three trips to India, and really it was that cremation. Watching that cremation, I said, there's enough for the book here. And it wasn't that I want, writing a book is, as anybody knows, unless you're Patterson or Grisham or somebody, you can never make money at it. So it has to be a passion. You don't write a book to make money. And I just felt this is another monumental experience that I would like to try and share with other people that won't really be able to go to India or won't really know what yoga means to, you know, to some people. And so I really felt compelled to do it. And when it's kind of like surrender and a duty, it became an honor and something that poured out of me without effort. So if I get that feeling again, maybe I'll put something else together, but I don't wake up and say, my gosh, what kind of material could I accumulate to make a book? So I don't know if that's an evasive answer, but that is my answer.
Well, let me remind listeners that the title of your newest book is Practice. The author is Kurt Kuntz, and we will look forward to, I think people will be curious to read your book, even if they aren't interested in yoga, which more people are these days. So thank you, Kurt, for being a guest today.
Oh, thank you so much, Nancy. I really appreciate it. And I feel honored to be a second time guest on your program. And I've enjoyed talking to you offline, too. Great, great moment.
Again, my guest has been author and adventurer Kurt Kuntz. His newest book is Practice.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.